Countdown for blast off. X minus 5, 4, 3, 2, X minus 1, fire. From the far horizons of the unknown come tales of new dimensions in time and space. These are stories of the future, adventures in which you'll live in a million could-be years on a thousand maybe worlds. The National Broadcasting Company, in cooperation with Galaxy Science Fiction Magazine, presents
X minus one.
Tonight, Hostess by Isaac Asimov.
I was so happy about it when I came home, almost triumphant. I dashed in the front door, peeled off my gloves, threw my hat on the side table, and tossed my coat over the back of a chair.
Well, you missed supper.
Drake, we're going to have him here.
Who here? What are you talking about?
The doctor from Hawkins Planet. Didn't you realize that was what today's conference was about?
When you say the doctor from Hawkins Planet, do you mean the Hawkinsite you've got at the Institute?
Well, of course. Who else could I possibly mean?
May I ask what the devil you mean by saying we'll have him here?
Darling, the Hawkinsite would like to stay at a private house somewhere where he won't be bothered with official ceremony, where he'll be able to proceed more according to his own likes and dislikes. I find it quite understandable.
Yeah, whenever you start using formal sentences, I know you're hiding extreme irritation.
Well, you don't seem to be trying to hide it at all. Well, what's the matter?
Look, I don't see where we've got room for extraterrestrial visitors.
Are you serious? He can stay in the spare room. Honestly, Drake, all we have to do is show a certain amount of adaptability.
Sure, just a little adaptability. The Hawkinsite breathes cyanide. We'll just adapt ourselves to that, I suppose.
He carries cyanide in a little cylinder. You won't even notice it.
Mm-hmm. And what else is there about them I won't notice?
Nothing else. They're perfectly harmless. They're even vegetarians.
Well, what about us? Do we eat meat ourselves? Or will that make us look like cannibals to him? I won't live on salads to suit him, I warn you.
Drake, it means very much to me.
Well, why?
Because if he stays here for any length of time, I can study him real closely. Very little work has been done on the biology and psychology of the individual Hawkinsite or of any of the extraterrestrial intelligences. Surely you must see the opportunity. He stays here. We speak to him, watch him, observe his habits.
Look, I've spoken to men who are in charge of security groups watching various Hawkinsite missions on Earth. The missions stay in the rooms assigned to them. They don't leave for anything but the most important official business. They have nothing to do with Earthmen. It's quite obvious that they're as revolted by us as I personally am by them.
Drake, he's a doctor. He's coming here for medical research, and I'll grant you that he probably doesn't enjoy staying with human beings and will probably find us perfectly horrible. But he must stay just the same.
All right. Have it your own way. You sure you don't want any coffee?
No. Drake, you're not angry about this, are you?
No, I'm not angry.
Most of my friends had been surprised when I married Drake because they couldn't understand my marrying a policeman. I explained he wasn't simply a policeman. He was a member of the World Security Board, but most of the staff at the Institute thought it rather odd that I hadn't married a biologist or at least an anthropologist, even a chemist, but certainly not a policeman. I was waiting for Drake with some apprehension that evening as I sat in the living room. Hark Tolan, the Hawkinsite, was standing quietly in the middle of the room. He was not sitting, since he was not anatomically constructed to sit. He stood on two sets of limbs placed close together, while a third pair, entirely different in their construction, were suspended from a region that would have been the upper chest in the human being. His skin was hard, glistening, and ridged, and his face wore a distant resemblance to something alienly bovine.
Mrs. Smollett, you must forgive my English. The construction of my mouth, combined with the absence of incisors and canine teeth, is an obstacle to clear speech.
I think you speak very well.
Thank you.
My husband will be home soon, and then we'll eat.
Your husband?
Well, husband? Yes, you know. Mr. Smollett.
Ah, Mayo, of course. You must forgive me, Mrs. Smollett. Perhaps the greatest source of confusion among the five known races of the galaxy lies in the differences among them in regard to their sex life and the social institutions that grow around it.
I understand that.
The concept of husband and wife, for instance, exists only on Earth. I can achieve a sort of intellectual understanding of what that means. Never an emotional one.
Dr. Tolan, I've consulted the Institute in preparing a menu, and I trust you'll find nothing in it that will upset you. Drake? Drake, is that you?
Yeah.
I'm in the living room, dear.
I suppose he's all delivered, complete.
Drake, this is Dr. Hark Tolan of Hawkins Planet. Dr. Tolan, my husband.
Good evening, Dr. Tolan.
Mr. Smollett.
Would you care for a drink?
I'm not particularly thirsty.
On Earth, there is a custom of drinking liquids which have been fortified with ethyl alcohol. We find it stimulating.
Oh, yes. I'm afraid, then, that I must decline. Ethyl alcohol would interfere most unpleasantly with my metabolism.
Well, so it does to Earthmen, too. But I understand, Dr. Tolan. Would you object to my drinking?
Of course not.
Good. I need one. A stiff one.
He stood at the table. I tried not to look at him as he ate. His wide, lipless mouth split his face alarmingly as he ingested food, and in chewing, his large jaws moved from side to side. There was evidence of his ungulate ancestry. I found myself wondering whether he would chew his cud later, and then I was afraid that Drake would get the same idea and leave the table in disgust, but he was taking everything quite calmly.
I imagine, Dr. Tolan, that the cylinder at your side holds cyanide.
Quite so.
Pure cyanide?
I hope you are not considering possible danger. I know the gas is highly poisonous to you, and I do not need a great deal. None of it emerges, except when I actually suck at the tube, which is fixed at the corner of my mouth.
I see. And you really must have the gas to live?
Are you not a biologist, Mr. Smollett?
No, Dr. Tolan. It's merely a minor government official. My wife's friends call me a policeman. Tell me, what happens if you don't breathe cyanide? Do you just go like that?
Not quite. The absence of it would be equivalent to slow strangulation.
Mm-hmm.
It's also very painful, difficult to treat. I've done some research on the problem.
I find it difficult to keep thinking of you as a doctor.
I understand what you mean. I find it difficult to think of you as a policeman.
I gather that you're not here on a pleasure trip.
No. I intend to study this queer planet you call Earth.
Queer? In what way?
It's always amazing to me to find how little you Earthmen understand your own characteristics. There are five intelligent races in the galaxy. Over and over, it is you Earthmen, more than any of the others, who are unique. Your people are the only ones which find hydrogen cyanide poisonous. Yours is the only form of intelligent life which is carnivorous. Yours is the only form of life which has not developed from the grazing animal. And most interesting of all, yours is the only form of intelligent life known which stops growing upon reaching maturity.
Well, you don't look very large, Dr. Tolan. I should say that you're an inch taller than I, which would make you 6'2". Are you young, or are you just small on Hawkins' planet?
Neither. We grow at a diminishing rate with the years, so that at my age it would take 15 years to grow an additional inch. But we never entirely stop. And, of course, as a consequence, we never entirely die.
Did you hear that, Rose?
I never knew that before.
You mean people on Hawkins' planet are immortal?
No people are truly immortal. Few of us live more than several centuries of your time. Still, it is unpleasant to think that death may come involuntarily. It is something which to us is extremely horrible.
Oh, we're quite used to it.
You Earthmen live with the thought. We do not. This is why we are disturbed to find that the incidence of inhibition death has been increasing in recent years.
What is this inhibition death?
A pathological cessation of growth. It's a wasting disease. A tragic one. absolutely incurable. It's fatal within a year.
What causes it?
Mr. Smollett, we know nothing about the cause of the disease.
Well, then why did you come to Earth to study it?
Because, again, Earthmen are unique. They are the only intelligent beings who are immune. The inhibition death affects all other races, while Earthmen are immune. Somewhere in the biochemistry of the Earthite, there is the secret of that immunity. How interesting it would be to find it.
Well, now, look here. You can't say that Earthmen are immune. From where I sit, it looks as if the incidence is 100%. All Earthmen stop growing, and all Earthmen die. We've all got the inhibition death.
Earthmen live up to 70 years after the cessation of growth. That is not death as we know it. Your equivalent disease is rather one of unrestrained growth. Cancer, you call it.
Drake was being pleasant to Dr. Tolan. I wasn't sure whether it was for my sake or for his own. Drake has never gone out of his way to please me. Sometimes when I'm gloomy, I look at him across the table and ask myself, why did he marry me? And suddenly after dinner in the living room, Dr. Tolan asked a question which surprised me.
You are a policeman, Mr. Smollett?
Yes.
I wonder, could you show me through one of the police departments on your planet?
Well, I don't belong to a police department in exactly the way you imagine. However, I have some contacts in the New York City Department.
Would I be able to visit the Missing Persons Bureau?
Why are you interested in the Missing Persons Bureau?
Because there again, you are unique. There's no such thing as a missing person on our planet. We're always aware of each other's exact location, no matter where on the planet we might be.
Can you feel such awareness even now, on Earth?
You mean across space? No, I'm afraid not. But you see the importance of the matter. All the uniqueness of Earth should be linked. If the lack of this sense can be explained, perhaps the immunity to inhibition death can be also. Tell me truthfully, Mr. Smollett, if Mrs. Smollett were to leave this room and enter another without your having seen her do so, would you really not be aware of her location?
I really would not.
Amazing. Please do not be offended by the fact that I find it revolting as well.
Drake?
Yes, I'm awake.
Why were you talking about the inhibition death to Dr. Tolan?
I'm taking an interest in your work, Rose. You've always wanted me to take an interest.
I'd rather you weren't sarcastic.
Rose, I'm tired. I'll talk to you tomorrow.
No, right now.
I want no questions from you and no interference. You do your job and I'll do mine.
The nature of my job is open and known.
The nature of my job isn't, by definition, but I'll tell you this. Our six-legged friend is here in this house for some definite reason. You weren't picked as biologist in charge for any random reason. 2 days ago, he'd been inquiring about me at the commission. But that's my job, and I won't discuss it with you any further. Do you understand?
No. But I won't question you if you don't want me to.
All right, then go to sleep.
I lay stiffly on my back, and the minutes passed and the quarter hours. I was trying to fit the pieces together. One picture remained clear in my mind. It hovered over me mockingly. At the end of the evening, the Hawkinsite had turned to me just before he left the room.
Good night, Mrs. Smollett. You're a most charming hostess.
I wanted to giggle then. How could he call me a charming hostess? To him, I must have been a horror, a monstrosity with too few limbs and too narrow a face. But then I saw Drake. He turned white. For one instant, his eyes had burned with something that looked like terror. I'd never before known Drake to show fear of anything. And the picture of that instant of pure panic remained with me until all my thoughts finally sagged into the oblivion of sleep. I remember one question that nagged at me through the haze. Why did he marry me?
I found your missing persons bureau interesting. in that the large majority of missing persons are males.
Oh, well, that's not mysterious, Dr. Tolan. You simply didn't realize the economic setup we have on Earth.
My wife is an example of the minority of women who are capable of making their own way in the world.
Would you call the Missing Persons Bureau of New York a fair sampling of such cases in the planet at large?
Yes, I should think so.
Is there then an economic explanation for the fact that since interstellar travel has been developed, the percentage of young males among the missing is more pronounced than ever?
Well, that's even less of a mystery than the other. Nowadays, a runaway can hop the nearest space freighter. They're always looking for crewmen. No questions asked.
It's almost always young men in their first year of marriage.
Well, that's just the time a man's troubles seem the greatest. If he survives the first year, there's usually no need to disappear at all.
Would it offend you if I disconnected for a period of time?
Disconnected?
It's like sleep. Oh. I hope you haven't had too exhausting a day.
It's just that I've been absorbing so many new and unusual concepts that I feel a desire for a little disconnection.
Drake, we've been sitting here for 10 minutes. Aren't you going to speak to me?
About what?
Last night you said you'd speak to me tomorrow. Well, I'm ready now.
I thought it was agreed that you wouldn't question me about my business in this matter.
I think it's too late for that. I know too much about your business by now.
What? What do you mean?
Drake, let go of my arm.
What are you talking about?
Dr. Tolan thinks that Earth is spreading the inhibition death purposely. That's it, isn't it?
Where did you get that idea?
It's true, isn't it?
I want to know exactly why you say that. Don't play games with me, Rose. This is for keeps.
Why don't you ask Dr. Tolan? He's an outstanding worker in the field. I looked over his papers this afternoon.
And what are his theories about the origin of the disease? Try to remember, Rose.
I think he blames Earth, but I think he admits they know nothing about how the disease is spread.
I'll find out about this right now.
Drake, what are you going to do? What's that?
That's my gun. I'm going to ask him a few questions.
He ran out of the bedroom, down the corridor, towards Dr. Tolan's room. I ran after him, caught him just as he entered the door. The Hawkinsite was standing there, motionless, his eyes unfocused, his four standing limbs sprawled out in four directions as far as they would go.
Now keep quiet. He'll gradually become aware of me. Get out of here.
No, Drake. What are you doing?
Quiet. There, you see? The skin on his face is beginning to quiver. Well, that's about all, Dr. Tolan. Don't throw in connection with any of the limbs. Your sense organs and the voice box will be quite enough.
Why do you invade my disconnection chamber? And why are you armed? What do you want?
The answer to certain questions.
With a gun in your hand? Sorry, Mr. Smollett, that the duties toward a guest are so badly understood on Earth.
You're no guest of mine, Dr. Tolan. You entered my home under false pretenses.
You had better shoot. It will save time.
You are convinced that you'll answer no questions? Now, that in itself is suspicious. It seems that you consider certain answers to be more important than your life.
I consider the principle of courtesy to be very important. You as an Earthman may not understand.
Perhaps not. But I can understand one thing. Your cyanide cylinder, suppose I... Pull it out of your mouth. Rose, hold your breath until I close the valve. There. All right, Tolan. You realize what will happen to you if you don't answer the questions I'm going to ask you. Cyanide lack. It would be a most uncomfortable death. I'm only an Earthman. I can't appreciate its true horrors, but you can, can't you?
Drake, give him the cylinder. Give it back to him.
You have about 1 hour, I think, until the effects are irreversible. Talk quickly, Dr. Tolan. You'll have your cyanide cylinder back.
What are your questions?
What are your theories concerning the inhibition death? Why did you really come to Earth? What is your interest in the Missing Persons Bureau?
For years, I have been investigating the cell structure of my patients suffering from inhibition death. I've been forced to use the utmost secrecy, since the methods I used were frowned on by my people. Your society would have similar feelings against human vivisection, for instance. For this reason, I could not present the results I obtained to my fellow physicians until I had verified my theories here on Earth.
And what are they?
The inhibition death is entirely a disease of the mind.
You mean it's psychosomatic?
No, Miss Smollett, it is not psychosomatic. It is a true disease of the mind, a mental infection. My patients had double minds. Beyond and beneath the one that obviously belonged to them, there was evidence of another one, an alien mind. In short, there are not only five intelligences in the galaxy, but six. And the sixth is parasitic.
This is impossible. You must be mistaken, Dr. Turner.
No, I'm not mistaken. One can imagine such a parasite through the course of millions of years, perhaps losing all portions of its physical being. It would become nothing but pure mind, living in some mental fashion we cannot conceive of on the minds of others, particularly on the minds of Earthmen.
Why particularly Earthmen?
Have you not surmised that the sixth intelligence is a native of Earth? Mankind from the beginning has lived with it, has adapted to it, is unconscious of it. It is why the higher species of terrestrial animals, including man, do not grow after maturity and eventually die. And it is what is called natural death. It is the result of this universal parasitic infestation. Where Earthmen could survive the infection for decades with little harm, we others die a quick death, within a year. Give me back my cylinder. You have your answer.
What about the Missing Persons Bureau?
Drake, look at his eyes. Give it back to him.
As we are not well adapted to the intelligence that infests man, neither is it well adapted to us. It can live on us, but it cannot reproduce, with ourselves alone as the source of its life. The inhibition death is therefore not directly contagious among our people.
What are you implying, Dr. Tolan?
The Earthman remains the prime host for the parasite, and an Earthman may infect one of us if he remains among us. But the parasite, once it is located in an intelligence of the outer worlds, must somehow return to an Earthman if it expects to reproduce. We are infected and reinfected as the parasites return to Earth and come back to us via the mind of Earthmen who travel through space.
And the missing persons?
Are the intermediate hosts. The masculine terrestrial mind seems better suited for their purpose. But once reproduction has been taken care of, the infested male leaves by spaceship for the outer worlds. He disappears.
But this is impossible. What you say implies that the parasite mind can control the actions of its host. That can't be, or we would have noticed their presence here on Earth.
The control may be very subtle, may moreover be exerted only during the period of active reproduction. I simply point to your Missing Persons Bureau. Why do the young men disappear? I'm quite ill now, cyanide lack, and I cannot speak much longer.
And you alone, of all your people, have any knowledge of this theory of yours?
I alone. You will give me back my cyanide cylinder now. I have become quite weak.
Sure. Sure, Dr. Tolan.
Rose. No, no!
Rose, come out of here. Come on now. Come on.
He's dead, you shot him.
Outside. Out. Quiet, Rose, quiet. I told you to have nothing to do with this.
Let me go. I want to go away. I want to go away.
Why? Because of something it was my job to do? You heard what that creature was saying. You suppose I could allow him to return to his world and spread those lies? They'd believe him. What do you think would happen then? They would have to kill us all to stop that disease.
What he said wasn't a lie. It was true.
Oh, come on, now you're hysterical. You need sleep.
I know what he said was true because the Security Commission knows all about the same theory and knows it's true.
Why do you say a thing like that?
Because you let it slip yourself.
Now, sit down. Sit down. Well, so I gave myself away, did I? When?
You turned white when Hark Tolan referred to me as a charming hostess. Hostess has a double meaning, Drake. A host is one who harbors a parasite.
Well, I had no idea I was so transparent. Look, Rose, I've done my best to keep you out of this.
The truth can't be held down forever. Somebody else will find out. You can't kill them all.
We know that, too. We have no choice.
Why? Why can't we combine with the other intelligences and wipe out the parasite?
No, you don't understand. Hark Tolan was right. Man and his prehistoric ancestors have been living with this parasitic intelligence for uncounted ages. We've not only become adapted to it, we've become dependent on it. It is no longer a case of parasitism. It's a case of mutual cooperation. You biologists have a name for it.
What are you talking about? Symbiosis?
Yes, exactly. We have a disease of our own, remember? It is a reverse disease, one of unrestrained growth. We've mentioned it already as a contrast to inhibition death. It's all very well to say that if we could remove the parasite, we would have eternal growth in life, but it's impossible for us. If for any reason the parasitic intelligence, as Hark Tolan calls it, does leave the human body, or if its relationship to the human mind is in any way impaired, growth does take place, but not in an orderly fashion. We call the growth cancer, and there you have it. There's no way of getting rid of the parasite. We're together for all eternity. To get rid of their inhibition death, extraterrestrials must first wipe out all vertebrate life on Earth. There is no other solution for them. So we must keep knowledge of it from them. Now do you understand?
He got the body out of the apartment. I sat there numbly. He lied to me. Cancer could not be a disease that was an expression of lost ability for normal growth. Cancer attacked children while they were still growing. It could even attack embryonic tissue. Cancer had nothing to do with the presence or absence of normal growth. Its absence would not cause cancer. Drake lied, but no one would believe me. The young men who disappeared were usually in the first year of their marriage. Whatever the process of reproduction of the parasite intelligence was, it must involve close association with another parasite. The type of close and continuous association, as in the case of newly married couples. The parasite could control actions. I'd report them both, Drake Smollett and Hark Tolan, to the Missing Persons Bureau. But they'd never find them, for they'd be out in space. I wanted to weep, but I couldn't. I was dry-eyed, and it was painful. I'd looked for the answers to so many questions, and I'd found them all. I even found the answer to the question I thought had no bearing on the subject. I finally learned why Drake had married me.
You have just heard X-1, presented by the National Broadcasting Company, in cooperation with Galaxy Science Fiction Magazine. Your announcer, Fred Collins. X-1 was an NBC Radio Network production.
Last year, over 650 BC teens aged out of foster care without a permanent family.
Adoption is not just for babies. Teens need families too. Only 24 teens in BC were adopted last year.
November is Adoption Awareness Month. To find out more about adopting a teen, contact the Adoptive Families Association of BC. Call 1-877-ADOPT-07 or visit us at bcadopt.com.
Tonight, we take pleasure in bringing you Suspense, a weekly anthology of notable melodramas from stage and screen, fiction and radio, presented each week to bring you to the edge of your chair, to keep you in suspense.
Apparently, I have committed the perfect crime. I can say the murder was justified, which it most assuredly was, if murder ever is. I can rationalize it as I will, but the fact remains that I have deliberately taken the life of a fellow man. I think I know what the Black Madonna would say if she could speak. For after a fashion, she has spoken. The first time I ever heard of the Black Madonna, was when Aunt Bee sent me a cryptic, somehow vaguely alarming note.
Paul, darling, I'm about to die a violent death. The Black Madonna says so, and you know, of course, that she is never wrong. Could you run up here for a few days, and not a word to Etienne about this when you arrive? Won't you please come, Paul? I'm frightened.
I hadn't seen Aunt Bee since her return from France, where she'd been trapped for years by the war. But just as usual, she took it for granted that I'd know just what she was talking about. But I didn't. What did she mean about dying a violent death? And who was the Black Madonna? And who in the hell was Etienne? Though knowing Aunt Bee, I could take a guess as to the latter. Anyway, I shut up shop immediately and drove north along the coast highway, then negotiating the tricky mountain roads to her place, La Casa Encantada. Hello? Aunt Bee?
Paul, sweet! I knew you'd come to see me before I get hit by a truck or fall off a cliff or whatnot. Have a piece of toast, lover. Isn't this weather gorgeous? Oh, that's a handsome tie. You look more like your mother every day, you know.
What's all this nonsense now about your dying a violent death?
Oh, Paul, I'm afraid it's really true. The Black Madonna's never wrong. So I got old hooks up here and revised my will, with everything going to Etienne, that is, during his lifetime. But really, Lamb, it's to be held in trust for you. He can't sell a single solitary thing, only enjoy the income, and when he dies, you'll get everything. Of course, that'll be years and years from now. He's only 26, just your age.
Aunt Bee, please. Suppose you tell me first who Etienne is.
Paul, lover, surely you know. Etienne's my new husband.
Aunt Bee, not again. You haven't acquired a seventh.
Sixth, darling. After all, I married that redheaded one twice. You know, the one who used to throw gin bottles at poor Hawkins. What was his name again? Bruce? Yes, that's it. So you see, he only counts once. Etienne's a dear boy, and he doesn't care a hoot about my money. But he's madly in love with me, even threatened suicide if I didn't marry him. Besides, he has such a pretty name. Etienne de Marsigny. So naturally, I had to marry him. So you see, dear, it really was a very reasonable marriage this time. Now, wasn't it?
Of course, Aunt Bee. Very reasonable. And I know you'll be very happy. You mentioned someone called the Black Madonna? You said she told you...
Well, she didn't tell me exactly. Well, you see, she isn't... Oh, come on. I'll show you. That is the Black Madonna.
Why, it's an old painting of the Virgin and Child. Old, yes, but fairly commonplace, I would think.
Look closer.
On the left cheek of the Madonna, there's a small crescent-shaped scar. It seems to glisten moistly. However did the artist create such an effect? What the devil?
So, you've discovered it already, that the scar is bleeding.
But how can that be? What does it mean?
Shh! There's Etienne. He's been playing golf with friends. I can't stop to explain now. He doesn't like me to talk to anyone about the Black Madonna. Don't linger now. I'll tell you about it later. You can meet Etienne at dinner.
Aunt Bee seemed absurdly agitated for so little reason. She all but dragged me from the room to the hall, then left me to find my own way. I went up the fantastically grand marble staircase to the suite I always occupied during my rare visits. In the upper hallway, I ran into Minnie, my aunt's personal secretary for many years.
Oh, Paul, I'm so glad you're here. Miss Bee has been fretting something awful.
I know, Minnie. How long has it been going on?
Just for the last few days. She's been quarreling with... him.
Well, I'm sure everything will be all right.
I wouldn't be so sure. Did she tell you about the Black Madonna?
No, not really. She just showed it to me. Before she could say anything, Etienne arrived, and she hustled me up here.
So, did you see the scar?
I did. The damn thing was bleeding.
Damn thing might be a more accurate description than you realize.
What do you know about the Black Madonna?
About as much as is known. It came with a pamphlet giving its history. The Black Madonna was commissioned by the Archbishop of the Coptic Cathedral in Cairo in the 14th or 15th century, and it wasn't long before it had acquired the reputation that led to its dire name. The cathedral itself was pillaged again and again, and each time the Black Madonna was stolen, only to end up back at the church. On the first such occasion, one of the vandals must have used it for a target, perhaps in drunken sport, for the painted cheek of the Madonna had been scarred by a sword thrust. It was then that the truly weird aspect of its history began.
Truly weird aspect?
Yes, for it began to be noticed that archbishop after archbishop, titular owners of the painting, were all meeting violent deaths. And in each case, before they died, their deaths were presaged by the bleeding of the scar on the cheek of the Madonna.
Oh, come on. You can't be serious. The bleeding of the scar is probably just some action of heat or humidity on the pigment.
I'm dead serious, Paul. The cops believed it. In terror, they eventually sold the Black Madonna, just to be rid of it. From there, it passed from owner to owner, and each one of them met a violent end. And now, it belongs to your Aunt Bee.
Not saying I buy a word of this, but why in the world would she want to buy a cursed painting?
You know your Aunt Bee. She has a fatal weakness for beautiful baubles that will cause her nothing but pain. Like her husband's. Oh, I apologize, Paul. That was quite inappropriate.
And also quite correct. So he's just like the rest.
You'll find out soon enough. Dinner's just about ready.
I shaved and showered, then went down to dinner. Etienne de Marcigny was exactly as I had pictured him. A slimy serpent with hooded eyes and a furtive manner. The same sort that Aunt Bee had been conned by since the death of her first husband and their young son. I guess women would consider him handsome, and perhaps he was. But I can spot a phony a mile off. Still, I tried to be civil for Aunt Bee's sake. It wasn't easy.
Sir, Paul, your mother is Bee's sister?
She was, yes.
She passed away 6 years ago, Etienne dear. Now Paul and I are the only family each other have.
What? I don't count? I'm just your husband, after all.
Oh, silly. I mean blood relatives. I've tried to look after Paul, but he insists on going it alone.
You know I appreciate your offers to help, but I'm doing okay.
Oh, you mean with your little Packard dealership in Santa Luisa? Etienne, Paul works around cars all day, and yet his own automobile is perpetually broken down.
Not an ideal advertisement for your company, is it?
Aunt Bee is exaggerating.
So you're telling me that there's nothing wrong with the Clipper?
Just a broken door handle on the passenger side. I'll get it fixed when I go back to Santa Luisa.
Well, it's a shame you can't stay longer, but I suppose it's par for the course when you have to punch a clock, huh?
You never mentioned what you do for a living, Etienne.
Live, of course, huh?
Live? How? Exactly.
Oh, don't let him fool you, Paul. You should have seen Etienne when I first met him in Monaco. Didn't have 2 francs to rub together.
Now, Bee!
It's all right, dearest. We're family, after all. Now, Etienne wasn't financially able to court me properly. I had to pay for everything, including our wedding. But Etienne was ever so romantic and very diligent about keeping track of my expenditures on our behalf. Swore he'd repay every penny as soon as he received a sizable inheritance.
Uh-huh.
That's how I knew that this dear young boy loved me for me, not for my bank account. Oh, Paul, darling, you know I've had some bad luck with the mercenary sort in the past, but not this time.
I'm happy for you, Aunt B.
Let me tell you how we met in Monaco. It was at Le Grand Casino. You know how I do enjoy a good game of baccarat. Well, I was at the 100-franc table when this exquisite young man offered to give me pointers. And little did he know that I've forgotten more about baccarat than most men ever knew. Anyway.
Aunt B rattled on in her usual fanciful style for quite some time. Fortunately, she rarely waited for a reply, so I was able to listen with just half my attention and concentrate on Etienne. If he'd married Aunt B only for her money, he seemed to already be repenting his bargain. He sat in sullen silence throughout the meal, his handsome chin sunk on his chest. As soon as dinner had ended, Etienne excused himself, pleading tiredness from the afternoon's golf.
So, what do you think of Etienne?
Aunt B, if he makes you happy, that's all that matters.
Well, he doesn't always make the best of first impressions. But Etienne really is a dear boy, and I do hope you'll grow to like him.
When have I ever treated any of your husbands in less than a cordial manner?
You never have, darling. Not even the ones who deserved it.
So, I'm sure that Etienne and I will get along as well as we need to.
Well, I suppose that will have to be good enough.
For you, I will make every effort. Good night, Aunt B.
Good night, Paul, darling. I'm so glad you came. I feel safer now that you're here.
I don't like to remember that because of what happened next. At around 5:30 in the morning, I was awakened by screams of horror coming from the hallway. Minnie!
Oh, Paul! Paul! At the foot of the stairs! It's Miss B!
No! Aunt B's body lay on the marble floor at the foot of the stairs, her head bent in such a terribly unnatural angle that I knew without a doubt that she was dead. At that moment, all I could think was that she should have met a kinder fate. For life had dealt her so many blows, and she'd always met them with such sprightly gallantry. For her, death might have come peacefully, instead of like a vandal in the night. Then I heard Minnie come down behind me, and I did my best to comfort the heartbroken woman. What's there to cry for? She's happy now at last.
No.
She's with Steve and little Billy.
I know. I know, Paul.
Good God. I had her sometime during the night, but I was only half awake. She couldn't sleep. She said I was going downstairs for the book. She must have tripped. Oh, B, why did this have to happen?
I just can't believe it.
But even as he wailed in grief, I saw his dark glance go all about the great hall and its furnishings, and it said as plainly as words, "Everything is mine now." Minnie saw it too, for her sobs caught angrily, and the two of us left Etienne to his dramatics to call the authorities and mourn in a quieter, but far more heartfelt fashion. It was while we were waiting for the doctor and undertaker to come that I found myself doing a curious thing. Skeptical as I was, I went into the study just off the patio where the Black Madonna hung. I touched it gingerly, in curiosity at first. Then, with mounting surprise that made me question for a moment my utter disbelief of the legend. For the scar on the cheek of the Black Madonna was now quite dry. Etienne invited me, not too cordially, to stay on until after the funeral. I can't say I was particularly grateful for his invitation, but I stayed on nonetheless. On the morning after the funeral, Minnie came to my room, and from her conspiratorial manner, I knew there was something on her mind.
Paul, have you ever wondered if maybe Miss B's death was no accident?
What? What do you mean?
I don't think she fell down those stairs. I think she was pushed.
Pushed? But Minnie, who?
Him.
Etienne? I don't like him any more than you do, but that's a very serious accusation to make. Unless you have some proof.
Proof? No, I haven't any proof, at least nothing that would stand up in any court of law. But you know the story of the Black Madonna, how it always forewarns the violent death of the owner.
But Minnie, surely that's just superstition. Just a colorful yarn made up to enhance its value. We don't even know if any of its story is true.
That's not the point. The one thing we do know is that the scar does bleed. And even if the story was embellished, there may be some kernel of truth. Certainly some people believe it. For days before you arrived, Etienne had been fighting with Miss B about the painting. He wanted her to sell the painting, and he was just raving mad because she wouldn't. You know what? I think he'd been planning to do away with Miss B, and he was afraid that the Black Madonna would give him away before he could do it. That Miss B would guess he was meaning to kill her when she saw the Madonna bleeding.
Minnie, even if you're right, and Etienne did kill Aunt B, there isn't any way it can be proved now.
I know. I just needed to talk about it, I guess. I just hate the idea of him getting away with it.
But we don't even know that there's anything for him to get away with.
Don't we? Goodbye, Paul.
Minnie's accusations left me in a quandary. As far as I was concerned, murder was something you read about in the newspapers. I didn't want to think of it happening to someone in my own family. But just suppose Minnie was right. Was Etienne to get off scot-free? Now that suspicion had been planted in my mind, I just couldn't leave without finding out whether Etienne was guilty or innocent. I sincerely hoped he was innocent. But if he wasn't... In my mind, I saw the body of Aunt B so pathetically huddled there at the foot of the stairs. I would keep seeing it until I knew. And so, I waited until all the servants had left before making my play. I see that all the help is gone.
Yes. I discharged them all. I'm closing up the house and returning to France.
Good. Because I wanted to wait until we were alone to thank you. Nice going, Etienne.
What do you mean?
Getting rid of Aunt B. Something I've often wanted to do myself. But I lacked your nerve.
You can't prove anything.
Oh, proof. As a matter of fact, I wasn't asleep that night. And my door was partly open. I saw you.
You? You saw me push her?
Yes, I saw you. But you don't think I care, do you? After all, she's been a nuisance to me for some time. Always dragging me up here, away from my business, on some harebrained errand. I owe you a debt of gratitude, Etienne. Really. You managed it so neatly. You're a very clever man.
Why, yes. I suppose I am. And why shouldn't I admit it? I haven't anything to fear. After all. Even if I told you, it would be your word against mine.
Exactly. How right you are. Shall we have a drink?
Why, that sounds like an excellent idea.
Etienne was right in every respect save one. He did have something to fear. Me. It was the only way. He had to pay the penalty for murdering Aunt Bee, and I had to be his judge, jury, and executioner. In the eyes of the world, I would be committing a crime. And for that reason, it had to be the perfect crime, for I didn't want to put my own neck into a noose. I went to my room and considered ways and means. It was much more difficult than one would suppose. Having always led a law-abiding life, murder plots did not suggest themselves readily to my imagination. But then, the solution came, quite literally, to me.
The painting! The Black Madonna is bleeding again!
What? Nonsense!
I just saw it! Come look for yourself!
I was just going through some of Bee's papers when a bit of light glinting off the Black Madonna caught my eye. So I walked over to it. The scar on the Madonna's cheek was again glistening wetly with blood.
Calm down. There's a perfectly rational explanation.
I'm going to die. I'm going to die. Unless, maybe if I go away from here, if I hide from the Black Madonna.
Of course, Etienne, that's what you must do. Leave here immediately. Come, I'll drive you to the station. Terror is a powerful emotion. He wouldn't even wait long enough to pack a bag. He had money. Plenty of money, he said. He could buy whatever he needed when he was safely away. What wits he had were completely addled by fright, for it never even occurred to him to be suspicious of me. He practically dragged me to the car, and soon we were on the treacherous mountain road.
Faster! Faster!
I was glad to oblige, for I knew just the spot I wanted, a hairpin curve, halfway down a long grade. Just beyond the curve, there was a sheer drop of 2,500 feet. We approached the curve at 70 miles an hour, and I applied the brakes, cutting our speed sharply, leaving a long curve skid mark for the police to find later. We were almost at the bend. I straightened the car out of its skid and gunned it, my left hand on the door handle.
Slower! You can't make that turn at this speed!
How right he was! I didn't even try to turn. I headed straight for the white-painted guardrail.
What are you doing? You kill us both! I'm getting out!
But he couldn't, because of the door handle that had been broken for so long. Goodbye, De Marsigny. I'd broken my arm when I jumped, but I hardly felt the pain. And it would serve to make my story more convincing. Slowly, painfully, I walked back to La Casa Encantada to summon the police. But before I made that call, I did one thing. I went in and looked at the Black Madonna. The scar was perfectly dry. My story was airtight. I was going too fast. I jammed on the brakes for the turn. The car skidded on the loose gravel and went out of control. I yelled to De Marsigny to jump, but he couldn't. I'd forgotten that the door handle on his side was broken. No matter how they tried, they couldn't shake my story. A wire to my chief mechanic confirmed my statement that the door handle had been broken when I left to answer Aunt B's summons. Still, they persisted doggedly, regardless of the weight of evidence pointing towards nothing more than negligence. Till finally, I thought they believed me. I committed the perfect crime and would never go to the electric chair. But today, I'm not so confident. I must have slipped up someplace, and they'll be coming back for me. For the Black Madonna belongs to me now. And the Black Madonna is bleeding.
So ends The Black Madonna by John C. Alzadek and Dana Perry Hayes. Tonight's story of Suspense. Suspense is produced by Blue Hours Productions and recorded at Melrose Music in Hollywood, California. Tonight's radio drama was adapted for radio by John C. Alzadek and Dana Perry Hayes from the short story by Harold Lawler. Charles Rahi Chun was Paul. Susan Eisenberg was Aunt Bee. Rick Fetterman was Etienne de Marsignier. And Catherine Camet was Millie. I'm your host, Damon Crawl. Next week at this time, tune in again for another study in Suspense.
Last year, over 650 BC teens aged out of foster care without a permanent family.
Adoption is not just for babies. Teens need families too. Only 24 teens in BC were adopted last year.
November is Adoption Awareness Month. To find out more about adopting a teen, contact the Adoptive Families Association of BC. Call 1-877-ADOPT-07 or visit us at bcadopt.com.
Tune into Post Rock Friday from 10 to 11 with your host John P for the best in post rock, drone, ambient, experimental, and noise.
Discorder Magazine has been supporting local music for over 30 years. Thanks to the long-term support of the Rickshaw Theater, Discorder lives. Favorite bands are playing at the Rickshaw Theater. Check out their calendar just behind the cover of Discorder Magazine or at rickshawtheater.com.
And you're tuned in to CITR 101.9 FM. My name is Brian McDonald, and thank you once again for taking a listen to Skald's Hall. Coming up in a moment, we'll have Canada Post Rock with John. So from all of us here at CITR in Vancouver, please have a safe and happy weekend. And soon, tune in next time for another dose of spoken word entertainment, Friday at 9 at CITR 101.9 FM.